Elon Musk refused Ukraine's request to let their forces use Starlink to guide strikes deep inside Russia. Welcome to Debug the Hype. I'm Alex Morgan, and this show is not affiliated with Reddit or any subreddit. Today is August 8th, 2026. That single choice, a tech CEO saying no to a battlefield request, is the hook for a bigger conversation about private power, battlefield tech, and the limits of law in war. Japan's foreign ministry has formally protested after several U.S. government social posts use characters like Pokemon and Mario without permission, according to Mainichi Shinbun. The Pokemon company says it did not authorize those uses. The concrete issue is copyright and brand reputation, not just meme culture. Japanese officials told the U.S. embassy that public institutions need permission even when they post for engagement. Watch this, because governments leaning on pop culture shorthand can end up in real diplomatic disputes and legal costs that dwarf a single viral clip. Romanian firefighting teams and EU rescue aircraft have been mobilized to France to reinforce crews battling intense wildfires in Bordeaux and across southern regions. Officials describe mass evacuations and exhausted local services. EU briefings used the line that no country should ever have to face a disaster of this scale alone. The anchor here is the EU civil protection mechanism. It's already moving assets across borders, so this summer's fire season is forcing durable questions about funding permanent aerial capacity, not just short-term goodwill. At Leipzig-Halle Airport, a bus driver reportedly kicked an explosive-laden drone out of the air, prosecutors say, after the device was found near several Antonov transport planes used for NATO logistics. Authorities say the drone carried professional explosives and a detonator, and federal counterterrorism teams have opened an investigation. A senior lawmaker called the driver's action very daring and courageous. The practical kicker: drones are now a low-cost pathway to high-impact disruption of military and civilian supply chains, so expect accelerated debate about protective perimeters and counter-drone rules at logistics hubs. Elon Musk declined Ukraine's request to let its forces use Starlink to guide strikes deeper inside Russia, and that refusal lays bare a new and uncomfortable reality. Battlefield infrastructure can be privately owned. The request itself was specific. Ukrainian planners argued that equipping long-range drones with a satellite link could expand the strike zone to 500 kilometers, a concrete operational change that would let them target mobile launchers and logistics nodes far beyond the current front line. President Volodymyr Zelensky reportedly even sought help from the U.S. president to arrange talks with Musk. The chain of asks tells you how thin the line has become between state strategy and corporate judgment.
So what actually changed this week? The immediate change is not a new weapon or a new regulation. It's a refusal. Musk framed his decision as a risk management choice. He said he worries about escalation and pushed for negotiation, and that is, in itself, a political act. Starlink is no longer only a consumer broadband product for isolated users. Since 2022, it has been integral to Ukrainian command and control, frontline communications, and drone operations. When one firm controls that pipe and can flip a capability on or off, the strategic balance shifts in ways neither armies nor diplomats designed into existing arms control frameworks. Now the legal and policy pressures stack up. There's no clear international rulebook saying a private company must provide or deny access to capabilities that materially affect a country's right to self-defense. That gap matters. Imagine two scenarios. In one, a private operator voluntarily withholds a capability because they worry about escalation. In another, the operator sells or leases access to a third party that uses it to strike civilian infrastructure. Both outcomes impose costs on states and civilians, but they sit in different legal and moral boxes. The established levers of democratic accountability, parliamentary oversight, electoral pressure, export controls tethered to governments, work unevenly here. Where does a Congressional Foreign Affairs Committee act? Where does the host state's export control regime intervene when the technology sits on private satellites and on-the-ground terminal?
There are also operational dynamics worth spelling out. Starlink's architecture creates high-bandwidth, low-latency links that make real-time remote piloting and precision guidance for drones feasible at much longer ranges than previously practical. That matters because it changes targeting calculus. A defender who once focused on shooting down inbound munitions now worries about striking mobile launch platforms, depots, and the people who coordinate them. Denise Stillerman, cited in reporting, put it bluntly. Instead of shooting down arrows, we will hit the archers. If that expands the footprint of the conflict, opponents fear it could invite counter-escalation, including strikes further from the front or responses that target the satellites and operators enabling the attacks. Reddit threads were predictably divided, and those divisions mapped to real policy dilemmas. One camp praised Musk for acting responsibly to avoid a wider war. Another argued that withholding capability is tantamount to letting a private actor decide the survival odds of a nation under attack. Both have a point. The first leans on precaution. Fewer tools, lower risk of a spiral. The second stresses sovereign responsibility. States must have the means to defend themselves and should not be made hostage to a CEO's judgment. For a listener thinking institutionally, the real question is how to square these positions with concrete mechanisms. Mandatory licensing conditions for battlefield use of commercial satellites? A requirement that governments hold strategic reserve capacity beyond any single vendor? Or new norms that tie use of service in wartime to state approvals?
There are practical policy options to consider. 1. Governments can negotiate binding agreements with key providers. They could require wartime access rules as a condition for contracts or spectrum licensing. 2. States could invest in redundant, government-controlled satellite layers, think military comms or allied constellations, to avoid single-point dependence. 3. Export control regimes could evolve to classify certain remote control or guidance services as dual-use military items requiring prior authorization. Each option has trade-offs: cost, speed of deployment, and the chance of freezing innovation. Put another way, you can design for resilience, but that usually means higher cost and slower rollout. There's also a normative debate that won't vanish. Should private firms be allowed to make unilateral decisions that shape who can strike whom? The UN Charter frames the use of force as something between states, not companies. But modern warfare increasingly depends on private sector technology, satellites, cloud providers, cyber firms. We're living through the moment when legal categories have to catch up to technical reality. That's why people on the ground are nervous. The author of a Reuters piece noted that Starlink's role has already altered Ukrainian operations in the field, and now a CEO's no maps directly onto tactical limits.
Layer onto that the foreign policy angle. Zelensky asking a sitting U.S. president to intervene with a private CEO exposes the awkwardness of alliances. If the U.S. government were to pressure the company either way, it would raise questions about governmental responsibility for corporate actions and possible legal constraints on private speech and choices. If the government doesn't act, it risks leaving an ally exposed. That dilemma suggests why some analysts on the economics and geopolitics threads called for clearer, pre-negotiated rules between states and service providers, a kind of wartime service-level agreement for critical infrastructure. Now pivot to another development that underscores how raw and improvised this war has become. According to the Institute for the Study of War, Russian forces have formed what Moscow labels the 1st Ukrainian Volunteer Spetsnaz Brigade, pulling together several irregular units that reportedly include Ukrainian prisoners of war and coerced defectors. The ISW naming of battalions, Maxim Krivonoz, Alexei Berest, Alexander Matrosov among them, provides a concrete anchor for the claim, and at least one Russian military blogger has openly acknowledged the brigade's reliance on POW recruits.
If confirmed, that's more than a personnel shuffle. International law is explicit. The Third Geneva Convention forbids compelling prisoners of war to take part in hostilities against their own country. Human rights monitors and conflict researchers point to a pattern of abuse. Detention conditions, torture allegations, and mass casualty events like the 2022 Oleonivka barracks explosion that create the coercive environment enabling forced recruitment. The legal descriptor for compelled combat is simple and stark: war crime. Beyond legal labels, there are immediate human consequences. Prisoners forced into combat face near certain death or capture, and their families lose any help of organized, lawful prisoner exchanges. Russian authorities' motive here appears tactical as well as symbolic. Facing manpower strains and a protracted conflict with high attrition, Moscow has experimented with leveraging foreign and coerced fighters before. Turning POWs into frontline assault troops offers a short-term personnel boost, but it destroys any remaining protections prisoners have and amplifies the risk that captured soldiers are recycled into combat instead of being repatriated. From Moscow's internal perspective, creating volunteer brigades with Ukrainian faces attached serves propaganda aims. It ostensibly projects the image of willing Ukrainians joining Russia's cause, even while it erases lines between coercion and consent.
The international response sidelines are already in motion. Analysts on Reddit and elsewhere demanded accountability, sanctions, criminal investigations, and documentation for future prosecutions. Ukraine has a track record of seeking legal redress, both at ad hoc tribunals and through international criminal processes, and this development would fit within those channels. But investigations require access to sites, witness testimony, and forensic evidence that the conflict parties are often loath to provide. That's why war crimes researchers emphasize chains of custody, video metadata, and corroborating detainee accounts. The standard of proof for holding high-level officials accountable is high, and gathering it in wartime is perilous. There's a strategic risk, too. If POWs are visibly used in combat, Ukraine may harden its policies on prisoners and adjust battlefield tactics to avoid capture, which could increase civilian casualties and make surrenders less likely. It also complicates any negotiated settlement. When prisoners are weaponized, their value for bargaining shifts, and the moral calculus of commanders changes. Western policymakers watching from allied capitals will also reassess assistance and intelligence sharing, because the norms governing humane treatment of captives are core to the legitimacy of coalition operations. If one side weaponizes prisoners, it undermines the whole reciprocity upon which humane warfare, imperfect as it is, relies.
Linking the two stories is helpful. Both are examples of non-traditional actors reshaping wartime decisions. In one case, a corporate CEO's judgment alters tactical capabilities. In the other, irregular recruitment practices and detention abuses alter the human calculus of war. The common thread is that rules, legal, institutional, and ethical, are being tested faster than they can be updated. Online communities pick up on that. On Reddit, some users reacted with outrage to the POW reports and pressed for rapid sanctions. Others warned against rushing to judgment without forensic verification. Similarly, the Starlink debate splintered between appeals to short-term military necessity and concerns about escalation. So where does that leave policymakers and publics? Three concrete steps feel unavoidable. First, invest in redundancy. States reliant on commercial infrastructure for critical defense functions need parallel government-controlled options or legally binding agreements with vendors that spell out wartime access and limitations. Second, update legal frameworks. Export controls, telecommunications licensing, and international humanitarian law interpretations must explicitly address commercial satellite services and remote guidance systems so companies and governments have clear rules in conflict scenarios. Third, bolster forensic capacity. Investigating alleged war crimes or covert hybrid attacks requires timely, well-resourced forensics teams that can verify claims and preserve evidence for prosecutions or diplomatic responses.
None of those fixes is quick. Redundancy costs money, lawmaking is slow, and forensic work is painstaking. But the alternatives are worse. Leaving critical tools and people's lives subject to ad hoc private decisions or coercive practices risks normalizing dangerous precedents. Online forums will continue to argue these points loudly. The task for governments is to decide which of those arguments become policy. A final practical point worth flagging. This is not a theoretical moment for ordinary users or voters. The next time your internet connection is used in a crisis, ask who owns the pipe. The next time your government posts a meme, ask whether it cleared intellectual property boxes. The next time a drone is intercepted near an airport, ask whether supply chain resilience was part of planning.
The technical and legal knots being tied now will shape both how wars are fought and how democracies govern private actors with outsized strategic reach. If private networks can determine who can strike and prison walls can be turned into recruitment pools, the next phase of conflict will be fought as much by lawyers and engineers as by soldiers. I'm Alex Morgan. Debug the hype.